is, and you know the funny thing is it really can't be explained.
C is for
cauliflower.
Confusion. Creation.
Pickle. K is for
kitten.
Camp.
See, wait. U, unbearable.
U is for underground.
Oh, yeah.
Umbrella.
T. Trite.
Tremendous.
Torment.
Tire.
C. K.
I can't think of a U one.
T. T.
F is for famous.
Fun. Fumble. M is for Montreal.
Hello, dear listeners. As of March 16th, CKUT Studios will be closed until further notice. The programming on our airwaves will consist of a mixture of recent CKUT archives, new pre-recorded segments, and other relevant special programming. Thank you for understanding that we are taking these measures to protect the health of our staff and community members. Our upcoming funding drive will be postponed until further notice. Love, CKUT.
Going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
I'm Dean Spade. I'm mostly based out of Seattle, Duwamish territory. For about 20 years, I've been involved in different kinds of grassroots, anti-prison, anti-poverty, anti-border type of work, anti-war type of work. A lot of that has been in queer and trans movements, really pushing back against kind of the pro-cop, pro-military type of gay rights formation that emerged in, most of my adult life. And instead I've been part of the kind of racial and economic justice centered anti-colonial, anti-imperialist queer and trans world. And so that involves a lot of prison abolition work, supporting people in prisons and different kinds of cages. And I am a lawyer. I teach as a law professor now. And in Seattle, in recent years, I've been involved in groups trying to stop them from building new jails and prisons and trying to get the detention center in Tacoma shut down, defund the police, things like that.
We'll be kind of hitting this off and on throughout the interview, but you have a new book out about mutual aid. Tell us about it.
Yeah, totally. So this book that was published by Verso Press last month in October is basically tries to do two things for a very broad audience. One is describe the importance of mutual aid for building social movements, and two, talk about very specific models and approaches for some of the key pitfalls that happen in a lot of mutual aid projects, like burnout, conflict, difficulty making decisions together. And all the stuff where we're just all trying not to replicate the hierarchical systems that we were raised in and are used to working and living in, in our mutual aid projects. So basically it's it talks about the kind of three key, I define mutual aid as being when we do survival work together based in a shared understanding that the systems in place aren't going to meet those needs and actually are causing the crises that are putting people into, distress. And the book talks about kind of the three key benefits of mutual aid being one, obviously that it meets people's immediate survival needs. People are facing all kinds of disasters ranging from climate change created fires and floods and storms to the ongoing disasters of, racist policing and criminalization, immigration enforcement, et cetera. The second key benefit is that mutual aid is this vital on-ramp to build social movements and build resistance. Most people come into movements because they need something or because they really want to immediately help people who are in a crisis that maybe they've been in, or people they care about are in, or that they're worried about. It's the place where most people make contact with some kind of social movement or resistance work, and then, you know, deepen and build and learn about a broader set of tactics and strategies, or learn more complex accounts of the problems they're worried about and build their solidarities more broadly. So it's really vital, but it's, you know, pretty much invisibilized in like the fake narrative about social change that is, you know, dominant in the US. It's written out because we only talk about like changing laws and, you know, charismatic leaders. So mutual aid is vital for building the widespread massive amount of resistance we need. And then the third key thing about mutual aid is that it actually builds the world we want to live in. It's us building systems to meet our own needs and each other's needs, and trying to figure out how to make decisions together and how to live together and how to be people who can live collaboratively and collectively instead of through extraction and domination. And the other sort of general frame around it is just that, like, mutual aid is just one tactic in a larger, you know, ecosystem of resistance that is aimed at getting to, of course, the root causes of poverty and violence. So mutual aid is really essential both to bring people into movements, but also, like, it's part of all the other tactics, right? Like, it's part of the Montgomery bus boycott is like arranging all the rides, right? Or it's part of a strike is like making sure people who are on strike have food. Or it's, you know, all the occupations that we see, whether we're talking about like the Occupy encampments or all the encampments of unhoused people around the country, or you know, the occupied protest zone that just happened recently in Seattle. Like, the mutual aid is the infrastructure of those encampments. It's tents giving out food and water and, you know, giving people a place to talk about what's happening for them. That actually is what makes up that occupation. And also, even in just like street protests and fighting with the cops, it's like street medics. Like, that's a form of mutual aid. So mutual aid is like, in a lot, you know, it's essential to sort of all the other tactics and strategies that get to the root causes that we are working on. So that's kind of like the first part of the book is about a lot of that stuff. And then the second part is really just like based in my own experience of working in mutual aid groups for, you know, 20 years or so, and just seeing how like our conditioning in white supremacy, heteropatriarchy, capitalism, ableism, colonialism, all this stuff, you know, means that when we work together, all that stuff comes up between us and creates a lot of obstacles, like people really trying to dominate each other, or like one charismatic leader making all the decisions and other people being passive. And then, you know, eventually it adds up and people start to get really angry, or like people being really overworking and bossy and kind of doing speed up culture inside a group, or, you know, groups like moving really fast and not actually attending at all to like relationships or decisions inside, and then it like explodes in conflict and they become totally unable to do the stuff they were doing, or like people kicking each other out of groups. Like, there's just this kind of generalized thing of like that I think is partly from living, you know, in capitalism and white supremacy, of like people being really focused on like deliverables and like what the group looks like from the outside and what it does, and like inadequately having skills for looking at like how are we getting there, and are we making these decisions in a way that everyone's participating in, and that's going to lead us to not only relying on one main person. So we, you know, we're all bringing kind of all these wounds from living in this society into these groups, and we have a lot we need to do to figure out how to work differently together. So the second part of the book is a lot about that, like, you know, things like burnout, things about how to make decisions together, how to be with ourselves and each other when we're in conflict, and that kind of stuff.
You did a talk recently where you discussed how one of the things you were doing over the past couple of years was working to popularize the idea of mutual aid at the onset of the Trump administration.
It's hard to act, for me at least, to feel like I have a kind of like large scale view of what people doing, you know, autonomous work are doing, because so much of it, you know, it's not the like most visible work for lots of really good reasons. So I feel sometimes like I'm just, what I have is just collections and collections of anecdotes. But I think that, and also like, I just, to be honest, like I was like on good days, I'm like, wow, I see so many people who are trying to like use these really cool horizontal strategies in their groups and are, you know, building out like bigger and bigger groups. And I, you know, I think about, you know, projects that have really been impressing me. Like, I've been really impressed lately by Critical Resistance Portland. Like, they did a project where they were writing a letter to every prisoner in Oregon, and now they're doing a project where they're raising $200 for every imprisoned firefighter in Oregon. And I'm just like, wow, I haven't seen these kinds of mutual aid projects for prisoners like at that scale before. Like, sometimes I feel like excited and amazed, and then other times I'm like, oh my god, I'm hearing primarily about so many groups that are like falling apart with like all these intense conflicts that are sometimes about like really reductive identity politics or about, you know, people really being in a culture of disposability. And I'm just like, you know, very worried about the sustainability of projects that have emerged during the Trump era. And it's hard too, because some really, you know, there were some big setbacks of having a Trump presidency that I think we're seeing now with the Biden election, where it's like, when you have that level of right-wing visibility, everything to the, like, that's at all less extremely explicitly right and racist and rapist and all that stuff looks somehow like really lefty. So the bar gets really low, and all these things appear centrist that are so far right, which is like where we already are. And I feel like that is really visible now. Like people's, you know, like a lot of people during the Trump era were upset about what was going on, but also weren't mobilized to take more immediate action, but instead were just like, I'm just following the ACLU's lawsuits or these kind of more passive approaches, or I'm just going to get excited about helping people vote. And now I have to be excited about Biden, even though he's, you know, his politics and policies are, you know, going to be so, so deeply, deeply, deeply harmful and absolutely inadequate to meeting the crises that we're in. So it's just, I feel like on the one hand, we are at such a, like, you know, difficult apocalyptic moment on so many fronts that autonomous action is inevitable, because the very systems, you know, they're just like the level of different forms of collapse of particular systems are causing people to support each other to survive. And also those things are not in place sufficiently, and so people are not surviving. And so I actually like love to hear your answer to that question, because I feel it's particularly like the interviews you do on the show and the work you all are doing with this going down probably give you actually a more, you know, holistic view of what has been built over these last 4 years and what has not been built. And I think for me, it's like almost like depending on what mood I'm in on a different day, I feel like I notice more the things that are developing, or I notice more what's missing.
In the context of Seattle, I'm just curious your thoughts. I mean, it seems like definitely there's a mix of things you could say, but I'm just curious, especially coming out of such an intense period of conflict and then seeing that play out in different ways, whether it was the coming apart of the CHOP or the CHAZ, or, you know, just the continued street mobilizations. I'm just curious your thoughts.
Yeah. I mean, it's been a really interesting time. I think that the popularization of, you know, some form of abolitionist politics in this time, you know, I didn't know that in my lifetime that would ever go mainstream. So it's really interesting to watch when it happens. And to see the rain, you know, of course, the different attempts to recuperate the policing system in the face of that, and to see, like, you know, city council members come out and be interested in defunding and then slowly, you know, wheel that back in Seattle and cities all across the country. And then also to see the ongoing, you know, it's really interesting to see a lot of people who I'm deeply in struggle with who are, you know, anti-border, anti-prison, who have anarchist politics, you know, we're also trying out this city council strategy, and we're also trying to actually defund the police and see if that is possible. And that's a huge experiment for us. And there's a lot of debate inside our communities about how much to put into that and whether or not that's, you know, a dead end, and how to relate to these state structures. So all of that has been really interesting. And I think people have been doing a pretty good job, holding the complexity of all these tactics at once and using multiple strategies at once, and understanding that the only reason there's going to be any traction to actually get rid of the police budget is because of, you know, what happens in the streets, and that and then also watching, of course, like all the like liberals and nonprofits like swoop in and both try to take credit for all of the you know, for any shift that is happening, and also try to like grab up any city money as fast as they can. And that gets loose from the police budget, or as a concession from the mayor. So it's really like, I mean, it just feels like the volume was really turned up, or the speed was really turned up on a set of processes I've been in for years, in which lots of different coalitional groups are trying to like not get certain jails built or not, or, you know, basically find different ways to divert people out of the criminal punishment system. It's like, suddenly that was really happening. I think that one thing I would say about my experience with the Occupy Protest Zone or Chaz or Chop is that, and especially how it compared to Occupy Decolonized Seattle, which I was also present for, it felt like, you know, I was there often like flyering about this effort we were making to try to get the state to not build this new women's prison, or flyering with like resources for people who were struggling with mental health stuff. And so I was meeting and talking to a lot of people, and I talked to a lot of people who were there who were like, I just drove here from Idaho. I've come to join the movement. I've never done anything before. There was a lot of like really amazing, like new, fresh people, a lot of working class people, including a lot of working class Black people. And I didn't feel like the space necessarily had a lot of ways of welcoming people in, compared to like, I feel like Occupy Decolonized, there was a little bit more infrastructure of like, there was definitely like food and water stands and stuff at CHOP, which was really great. But I felt like there needed to be also more additional kinds of like political ed style programming, more like visible general assemblies. Like I was interested in how, that's like one lesson for me. And I think one thing that was happening in the politics of Seattle is like, there can be this kind of hesitancy in Seattle politics, like, well, am I the one to offer this? Am I the one to offer this? And maybe I shouldn't be the one. Like, there's this kind of like, and it's like so many people in that community have so much to offer, whether it's like, you know, like we really needed workshops there about sexual harassment, because like that is going to happen at any kind of gathering like that. I was hearing about that a lot. I was trying to find people who I know who do those workshops. Like, could you do one here? Could you just do a free one, few free ones in the field a couple times, you know, in the course of the weekend, just to like try that out, you know, like, and it just was hard to get people to offer things. As much as I think people offer things at Occupy, and I'm not sure what all the reasons for that are. I think parts of it were questions about like, should non-Black people offer things or not? I think that, you know, I think it's obviously essential that, I think it's essential that all kinds of people offer all kinds of things, because there's all kinds of people showing up there and we want to meet them all and hopefully, you know, offer them support to participate in a space. And there'd be people kind of like yell in the street yelling like, this is not a spectator thing. Like, and it was like, well, if people show up and you know, this isn't a place to just come and get high and drunk and sit in the park, but it's like, if people show up and nobody welcomes them into any other activity, they probably will like be look like spectators or like, get high and drunk and sit in the park. But whenever anybody was like building a giant art piece or doing gardening, like so many people would go and join that, because people really want to show up and like put hands on or talk to people about their ideas and break their isolation and be like, this is why I'm so mad I drove all the way here or whatever. So I guess that's like a big takeaway from me is like, what are all the different kind of tendencies in some of our activist spaces that might make us not be that great at welcoming, especially new people who for whom a lot of the ideas are new and really like bringing them in. And I think, you know, mutual aid is essential for that in so many different ways. And that mutual aid projects at CHOP were some of the most first contact points for people, like having somebody be willing to talk to you or offer you something is the place to start a conversation. So that was another observation. I think, you know, in general, I would say that like a lot of Seattle organizations are struggling with conflict, which I'm seeing everywhere in the country. I think the level of pressure on all of our activist organizing groups and projects is really, really high because of the pandemic and the level of need in our communities that we're trying to meet, the volume, and because a lot of our ideas are suddenly popular. And so then there's just like a ton more work to do to respond in new and different ways to both the crises and to wanting to connect all the new people who want to join, and also like these new weird concessions offers from governments and nonprofits and stuff, and trying to actually move those things in the right direction instead of having them be opportunities for rebuilding or expanding those forms of control. So there's just like, I'm also seeing that, but I'm seeing that, you know, also beyond Seattle, but certainly I'm most intimately seeing it in Seattle.
It's interesting you bring that up. That's something that's been articulated, I think, by a lot of people, just this wave of new people coming in. I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, this is what we've been asking for forever, and then it happens. And I feel like that's one of the best things, I feel like you said, about mutual aid, is that it gives something for people to engage in and do and kind of like build those relationships.
But it takes a lot of work. Like I see this in orgs. Like I think a lot of orgs and our movements are actually really bad at taking in new people, because it's actually hard. Like it's actually more, it's, you're like, oh, I wish there was more people in this group so that we wouldn't be so stressed out while we're trying to deliver all these groceries or write all these letters or whatever. But then new people are like a ton of work. Like, you want to make them feel welcome. You have to make sure they're oriented to the decision making. You have to like make sure they're trained up on not doing harmful things that are typical things that might be done by people. Like, and so I think a lot of groups just don't do it. And that keeps our work small and also like limits the, like, all the people it could reach.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, we're going to have to bring more people in if we're going to expand. Well, as you mentioned in the same talk, we were talking about, we'll link this in the show notes. You mentioned the inability of liberal and centrist approaches to build the capacity for struggle in the streets and also create dual power. But do you feel that our side was able to do that during the past 4 years? Have you seen that?
I think that's a good question. I guess when I look at, like, again, I feel like it's hard for me to really be general about this, but I will say that, like, when I look at things like some of the recent housing occupations, which I know you all have covered really well, like, you know, Moms for Housing in Oakland and LA, and then the recent win in Philadelphia, and then also, like, you know, more people using tactics like blocking housing court entrances. Like, I feel like there's a heightening of tactics, an increasing boldness of tactics. And that suggests to me that things are building and growing. Like, that seems to go with or be an indicator of people having like enough connection with others who they can take risks with, and having some kinds of formations where they're building trust and being able to be bold, and some kind of shared analysis they're building together to make them want to do that. And when I see things like how popular the Cops Off Campus campaigns are around the country, like, I feel like there is some kind of increasing capacity around some of the things I want to see most, which are bolder tactics and more mutual aid formations. And that, obviously, COVID, you know, ramped up the mutual aid a lot. And I think that's not necessarily easy. A lot of people join mutual aid projects, don't have any politics in place around how they're going to do it, don't have any structures, or, you know, and it's a rough road. But a lot of them then learn from some of those, you know, difficult obstacles, and then stay in the movement and keep trying and find other models and learn that other people have tried this before. And so I feel like, I mean, as conditions just deteriorate so severely as they are, I guess it could be an article of faith, but I hope and think that there is some kind of ramping up in capacity. But ideally, it is this very, like, decentralized capacity that can be a little bit hard to quantify.
Yeah, going back to the talk, you mentioned how strikes, riots, and other forms of revolt have led to the forcing of elites to grant concessions and give aid during times of crisis. I'm just really curious on your thoughts on how the state has reacted during the pandemic and what this means about the state's general strategy for containing people's anger, or how they view what they can get away with during the COVID crisis. I think this question is especially really interesting as we, you know, transition between the two administrations.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, I am... a very pivotal and influential book for me in my life, you know, as somebody who's, you know, I grew up on welfare. I care a lot about welfare benefits. I spent a lot of my life fighting for people to have their welfare benefits. Is that book Regulating the Poor by Francis Fox Piven and Clower, that, you know, that old book that's kind of this, like, Marxist account of, like, how poor relief systems came to be and how and why they expand and contract. And their basic theory, and, you know, it's a book that has a lot of gaps, but their basic theory has always remained interesting to me, which is that in times of crisis, in particular, where a lot of laborers have been displaced, and there's the fear of, like, uprising by displaced people who have kind of nothing to lose, and they are going to come for the rich people's loot, you know, poor relief plays this very pivotal role of, you know, it'll expand when that danger is more significant, and then it'll contract when that sort of uprising is less severe. And they talk about how poor relief has to always be very stigmatizing, and it has to be kind of, like, really, really, really inadequate, so that you would take any job and work in any dangerous way for any wage in order to not be in it. And there has to be a whole narrative about how people seeking poor relief are bad. And like, so it's this theory about this kind of expansion and contraction. And it's one that you can really see clearly with like the Great Depression. And then they spend a lot of time talking about the 1960s and 70s and the kind of uprisings against white supremacy that the government responded to by expanding access to welfare benefits for Black people, not actually giving people what they wanted, which was like, you know, land and an actual, you know, meaningful income and self-determination, but instead just like these crappy, stigmatizing, you know, inadequate welfare benefits. And so, and then it contracts again and with the extreme contraction of, in 1996 with the Clinton welfare reform. And so what you would think would be happening right now is what it looked like at the beginning of the pandemic, which is like all of a sudden people were talking about universal basic income and all of a sudden there was a stimulus checks and there was the expansion of unemployment benefits. And, you know, some states like Washington, where I live, even like granted a small thing to give undocumented people some benefits. So there was this kind of like, obviously it's like all poor relief. It's always like, too little and they can take it back whenever they want. And it doesn't reach the, you know, most stigmatized people. Like it doesn't reach, you know, sex workers, people doing other criminalized labor, undocumented people, et cetera. But it was like, oh, right, of course, there's this level of crisis that exposes like the brutal, brutal, brutal inequalities and people are not going to take it. And so they throw out some kind of chump change or some expansion. But then it ended and the conditions didn't get any better. I mean, we're hearing all these constant news stories about the lines for food banks right now, and they haven't given more. And so I am so curious, like, is that strategy still in place? And it's just a little bit, it's just slow because there's not enough threat in the streets yet. Or, you know, is that theory not true anymore? Do they have enough other ways of controlling us, you know, I mean, which are just so many, but, you know, the deep level of like passivity that people have been encouraged to engage in, and also the level of scapegoating that makes people think that the, like, not identify the proper targets of their rage. And, you know, I'll be very, very curious whether we see, as we head into worse and worse economic crisis, an actual expansion of poor relief or not. And, you know, so that that's something that I'm just really like questioning. I think clearly the uprisings against police violence and racism this summer did come with some concessions. I mean, mostly very empty concessions as usual, like changing the names of things or appointing task forces that don't do anything in most cities, or promising that they'll defund the police, but then, you know, only defunding 1% or something in some cities, you know, or doing like very minimal police reforms like chokehold bans or things like that, that, you know, have been proven to not make a difference. So we will, you know, I think that's, and yet I think a lot of people narrate that the revolt is over and, you know, important things changed because sports teams said things about racism and, you know, whatever. So I'm curious, like what does it take to assuage people's anger, and has enough of it happened around the summer uprising and then also with the pandemic? Like what will be the level of uprising, or will there be enough, what will be the pressure that leads to another wave of relief, and how, you know, limited and conditional and short term will that relief be? Because I am surprised, based on what I expected, that it never was renewed.
We're seeing like even the protests that are in favor of Trump staying in office, those are now switching to anti-lockdown protests. And this is kind of like mirroring what we've seen happen in like some European countries, where it's like the far right kind of takes the vanguard position in protesting against like the state's actions during the lockdown. I don't know. I'm curious your thoughts on that whole dynamic, where the far right kind of are the ones that are the ones most loudly articulating some sort of critique, but it's basically just saying like, you know, let everything go back to normal and some people are going to die. Screw it.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting. Like, I was interviewed yesterday, by like a journal that has a different, you know, not an anarchist politics. And they really wanted to dig deep into like this critique of mutual aid, and they were just like, how is this not just libertarian, like anti-state, you know what I mean? It's just like fascinating because it's like, yeah, like there's like these, you know, threads like, I also think that we should not criminalize people for not wearing masks. And I also think we should, you know, and I also actually would love to see like a mutual aid based public health response instead of a, you know, police and military backed public health response. And so, you know, which is not, I was trying to explain to this interviewer, like how the entire framework is so actually different than what I'm desiring, because the framework inside that, like, let's go back to normal is like, and also like, let's have a smaller state or something that they say, but really it's like, let's freeze frame like the most extractive, you know, concentration of wealth, and then keep protecting that extraction with enormous state resources, but take away anything that's actually redistributive downward. I mean, like, that's really what that politics is. And so it's like its version of like freedom from state domination is so exactly the opposite, of course, of like a mutual aid based, you know, massively redistributive, like everybody have what they need and nobody have a bunch of shit they don't need, politics. And I think this is really visible in this like really complex way in which the right can like turn out working class white people to protest against mask mandates and public health strategy, and at the same time those very communities, a lot of those people are working in the quote unquote essential jobs, which means like frontline low wage, you know, highly dangerous, and have the like ongoing health conditions that come from living in this for-profit health system. And you know, in the same way that those people can be mobilized to oppose you know, work to combat climate change, while they also are likely to live in communities that are, you know, going to be highly polluted, and they're likely to be left behind, as, you know, the storms and fires arrive. And so it's just this kind of like, yeah, there's just like such a deep contest about what constitutes freedom, I think, in these debates that's like, that underlies it all. And I feel like the right has done a really good job of like, articulating a version of freedom that that ties into people's like attachment to different kinds of like whiteness, even non-white people, but to like white ideals, that is mobilizing people.
Who knows when she
Thoughts on just the explosion of mutual aid projects that we saw at the start of the COVID-19 crisis?
I have a lot of questions that are like really hard to answer because there's not a way to actually there was a group doing a survey of mutual aid programs over the summer, and I want to ask them, like a different project, I want to ask them if they release that data. But I guess like one of my questions is like, have people seen a lot of attrition? Like, are a lot of people, like a lot of people volunteered at the beginning, but less now? Are people seeing burnout? How many of these groups have kind of fallen apart over the kinds of classic conflicts we see in, in groups doing this kind of work? Or are people actually feeling like they've got really good systems and are ready to keep bringing in more and more participants and approach to like the increasing crises coming with winter and with, the next storm or fire seasons that are going to come in 2021, or then, all the different kinds of, the increasing levels of hunger, et cetera. So those are questions I have. I've spent a lot of this year talking in depth with various people in these mutual aid projects to try to help them put in place things they've realized they've needed, like decision-making practices or stuff around dealing with conflict or, political ed in their group about disability justice, or just like you start doing the work together and then you're like, oh, yikes, like these hard things are coming up. And so trying to, we actually don't have a way to orient new people or whatever. And I wonder, part of the reason I've been putting this stuff out on my website forever, but like part of the reason I put the book out was just to hopefully reach more people with like this kind of, just so everyone doesn't have to reinvent the wheel, with just like some of the ideas around how that I've seen work in some groups around how people can make decisions together and like, facilitate meetings and just like all this kind of basic stuff that is very familiar to a lot of anarchists. But because I think a lot of people who'd never been politically involved before got involved in these mutual aid projects, which is amazing. And one of my questions also is like, I think that part of the reason that the protests against police violence this summer were so big was, of course, because a lot of people were like out of work, which is, and could actually participate in a different way. And that is, matches the historic trend of displaced workers being people who often come into the streets, and also displaced teenagers who are not in any, have no summer jobs, have no, aren't in various programs or schools. But I also wonder if a lot of people were part of mutual aid projects, for COVID mutual aid projects, and that made them be more likely to be in contact with other people who were like, this is what it's like for us all to go to the streets together. And they had someone to go with and they had a way in. How much have these COVID mutual aid projects helped mobilize people? Like, that's another question, and in the same way that I saw with Occupy, a lot of people came to Occupy. It was their first time ever doing something political. And at least in the cities where I've tracked it, a lot of those people went on after the Occupy encampments were destroyed by the police everywhere to do a lot of other political projects, you know, ranging from stuff for tenants to transit stuff to transformative justice work or other abolitionist work. So I'm just kind of like, that's another question I have is like, is this, are we seeing a whole new set of people gaining more skills and capacities to work together in these ways and more political awareness and desire to do different kinds of, you know, solidarity or to try bolder tactics or whatever. And I don't know the answer to that. But I think that's, you know, remains to be seen. I'm not even quite sure like exactly how we'll get that answer, except for as people's own accounts keep coming out over time.
So just continuing onward with the COVID-19, the pandemic has led to a cascade effect. There's millions of people that are experiencing hunger for the first time, maybe in their lifetimes. There's lots of people that are facing eviction. Lots of people are being laid off like never before. I'm just curious, you know, looking at the situation now as we go into 2021 and also with the new president, you know, the changing of kind of the political landscape, what do you think the tasks are ahead for us in terms of organizing mutual aid projects?
I mean, I think we need to do a lot more disaster preparedness of all kinds. Like that feels really essential, like literally like just like on the ground, neighborhood by neighborhood, block by block. I really think that there's just no reason to believe that anything about the new administration will address the you know, ongoing climate crisis, which just has something terrible in store no matter where you live. And I mean, living on the West Coast and seeing the fires and the smoke this summer and just the like, just, you know, you're just on your own. There's just nobody's helping people who are sick get air filters or, you know, there's just, so we really have to organize that. And I think we really need to, you know, the housing crisis is really extreme. And so what does it take to organize more direct action based mutual aid to keep people from being evicted and to take empty spaces over and ensure that people are housed? And then what does it take to coordinate food on a massive level and to just get tons and tons of people involved in such projects? Like we just need a lot more people power. And I think that means we really need to think about like about these tactics. Like how do we onboard lots and lots of people into projects? I think there's so many people who want to do something and feel like the world is terrible, but are pretty much deeply isolated by the ways that, you know, our society is shaped right now. And I don't just mean by COVID, but I mean by like internet culture and social media and other things that I think have led to increased isolation. So that's, I think, really in front of us. Like we need to be studying how people have succeeded at bringing lots and lots of people into mutual aid projects and keeping them there and having people feel like they really are co-stewards of that project and can be heard in it and can stay and should stay, and that it's a political home and that they're getting also emotional needs and belonging needs met there and, you know, all of that. And I feel like that's, we're not there yet. Although I think the COVID mutual aid projects gave us a sense of what it might look like for there to be a proliferation of projects. And some of them were pretty high volume with what they were providing, and some of them still are. I mean, I think the other thing is like, you know, the Biden administration is just like absolutely horrifying. And so I think there's a level of complacency for people after Trump. And so how do we turn up the heat? You know, I'm just thinking about like in the period at the end of Obama's presidency, when there was a lot of really, really powerful direct action mutual aid towards people facing deportation. There were people blocking deportation buses, and there was a lot of just lots of different kinds of support happening to migrants at the same time as like direct action to draw attention to immigration policy. And, you know, Obama's immigration policies were absolutely terrible. He deported more people than Trump, of course. And so if Biden's thinking about going back to that, how do we bring abolish ICE back to the surface? And how do we make that, you know, a giant effort that is tied in deeply with different kinds of mutual aid, ranging from like the bold type of mutual aid done by No More Deaths or done by the people who were doing the Not One More Deportation, you know, blocking buses or blocking deportations at airports, et cetera. And how do we also do it with, you know, direct support to people in immigration prisons and the communities facing, you know, these raids and these abductions of their community members and stuff. And so I think that that's like, that's just one example. We could look at that with climate, all the areas in which Biden is a total disaster, which are all the areas, you know. So how do we ramp that up? And I think especially for those of us in the prison abolitionist movement, with like this moment around COVID and prisons, it's like this is the moment to get people out of prison for so many different reasons. You know, because of the visibility of the illegitimacy of the system of policing and imprisonment after the summer's uprisings, and because of the, you know, obviousness of COVID being, you know, huge public health crisis on top of the existing public health crisis in prisons. And so what does it look like to use bolder tactics combined with mutual aid in that realm? And I think people are trying a lot of these things. There's been a lot of work to try to get people out. And I think, you know, there's just a lot, we just need a lot more people tuned into that work and lifting it up and trying it and making trouble, for us to see the kinds of gains that we need to save people's lives.
How do you think that these mutual aid projects can be more political in the sense of just kind of like outward facing, like their messaging, and also kind of attacking the legitimacy of the state and capital to meet our needs, while also encouraging things like dual power and self-organization?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I just want to say, I talk about this in the book, but I think there's actually a huge danger of co-optation of mutual aid projects. You know, it's like, I mean, governments basically do three things in the face of mutual aid. They ignore it, you know, and pretend just there's never, it's like it's not happening, even though it's actually what's like saving people after the hurricane or whatever. Or they co-opt it and they're like, you know, yes, our wonderful city in which we have these wonderful volunteers helping and they're working closely with the city, you know, that kind of thing where they make it act, they act as if it's part of and complementary to their, you know, failed strategies. Or they criminalize it, right? Of course, like the criminalization of No More Deaths or of the Black Panther Party's free breakfast programs or whatever. But that co-optation thing is really big. And in order to keep, like, in order to have mutual aid projects not be, like, defanged, you know, it's like, I think we have to strike this really interesting balance of having them be explicitly political. Like, this is politicized relief. This is a space where we are giving each other the things we need to survive, and we are openly talking about why we don't have them and how these crises were created. And also they need to be places that aren't just like full of really intense jargon and you can't participate unless you're already a card carrying, you know, abolitionist, blah, 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 right? There has to be an on-ramp, an entry point for new people who have not thought about all the politics of this yet, but are like, I've got to do something. I'm worried and concerned and upset and mad. And they also have to be places that have political ed that help, like, bring people together to talk about the root causes of the problems that the mutual aid projects are addressing, or else they're just like not mutual aid projects. They just become kind of volunteer projects or complementary to, you know, the ongoing extraction by providing band-aids on some of the worst, you know, manifestations of what that system is doing. So I think that's a complicated one. I think, like, when I've been in groups that I think have done that well, like in particular abolitionist groups of different kinds, like, it's like, we're like, yeah, hey, don't you hate this jail or don't you hate this detention center with us? Like, yes, please come join us. And also, we're going to keep talking all the time about why. So you don't have to be an abolitionist to join us. All you have to do is, you know, hate this one particular facility or not want this thing to be built. But we're going to then just keep on talking about why, where we're going towards abolition. And every time people are like, well, maybe we should be pushing this electronic home monitoring, you know, bill, or all these other things that we think are actually harmful and going to expand surveillance and caging, we are talking about why. So that it's like, there's a clear set of values inside the org and we're not afraid to name them. And also we're not enforcing them on new people and being like, you have to immediately believe everything we believe or you can't be here. And there's going to be like a judgy, snarky thing about it. So I think this is like also kind of a people skills thing that is like not really great on the left in general, of being able to be graceful about sharing information and being interested and willing to influence people and also being willing to be influenced and not being like judgmental that everyone's not on the same page yet. And I think that's hard for people on the left. There can be a lot of either like, I'm so afraid to say my values, especially when there's privileged stuff. People are like, well, I don't want to impose my values when we're giving out the stuff or whatever. And it's like, no, like it's like, I feel like that's not the right way to think about it, because it doesn't have to be a domination move. It can just be like an invitation to a conversation and some clarity about like, hey, this is why I do this. This is what I know about it. and finding ways to have conversations with people that elicit their questions and concerns about the causes of whatever the conditions are that we're addressing, and not being afraid to have that politics. So I think this is a complicated and, like, you know, nuanced piece, but I think a lot of groups aren't maybe thinking about it enough. And so then we get either the tendency of excluding people who don't already have our same perfect, whatever, you know, party line, or the tendency of you know, downplaying our more bold or anti-state root causes focused politics, and then losing opportunities to actually, like, deepen the organizing and deepen the solidarity, and have it be that you come here to get food and groceries, but it ends up we all go and, you know, to the protest against the transit hikes, or we all end up going and laying down the railroad tracks to block the coal trains together, because we've, you know, been actually building some shared analysis and building our solidarities together.
Thanks for listening to It's Going Down. Follow us online at itsgoingdown.org and on Twitter at @IGD_news. If you want to support us in the work that we're doing and keep us going into the future, go to itsgoingdown.org/shop. Again, that's itsgoingdown.org/shop, and give us a donation. Thanks for listening. Let's get back to it. Yeah, I was just thinking about experience in the UK, where there was an explosion there of mutual aid groups too. And it seems like, I mean, this is just my cursory kind of understanding of it, but it seems like the radical dimension of it, and kind of like the, just the politics behind it, really seemed to be kind of like muddled down a little bit, I guess.
Yeah. And we, I mean, we, you know, we live in a context of, in, you know, a certain kind of capitalism that's like, you know, I'm thinking about like George H.W. Bush's 1,000 Points of Light, or Reagan's push for volunteerism. Like, you know, the right wing loves the idea that, like, we'll all just take care of each other through our church or something. And, like, yeah, too bad that we're going to leave out queers, and we're going to leave out, you know, undocumented people, whatever. Like, just this kind of like deregulated, volunteeristic, privatized sort of charity model is something that is actually really great for the right and for different kinds of, you know, austerity frameworks. And so we really need to have a politics that's clear about that. And it's like, how do we move people from kind of like, I just volunteered in my neighborhood because I want to be connected and break my isolation, and kind of can have a liberal sort of edge to it, where we all come together and survive the pandemic, to like, oh, wow, I just actually realized that some people in my neighborhood live like in low income housing, and they actually have really worse conditions. And they, you know, when the smoke came, it was much harder for them because they don't have any air conditioning, or like whatever, like where people actually cross some of the divides and become like more aware of the dimensions of the problem. Or, you know, I'm in this because I'm so upset because my kid's in the prison, but I actually just met somebody whose family is in the detention center. I never thought about how those are connected, and now I am. Like, how do we move people to greater solidarity through how we do the work? And I think that that like, it's like that part of the reason also that I wanted to put out this book and some other stuff, like the website around mutual aid that I've been doing for a while and stuff, is just like to get, ideally, to get some of those ideas circulating amongst people who are doing this stuff for the first time, that it's got a bigger role in resistance than might at first appear.
Yeah, in the U.S., it was really interesting to watch as the mutual aid groups proliferated, just the degree in which state propaganda was put out of just like, you know, everyone do your part, you know. Like, they wouldn't say mutual aid, but it was very much like, you know, neighbors helping neighbors, or helping hands across America, or...
Yeah, I mean, two examples of that I saw, like, one is I really saw, like, the mainstream media, like, discovered mutual aid this year, and I just saw them trying to make it non-threatening. So, like, this article that came out that was, like, really focused on how during Hurricane Sandy, Occupy Sandy people at one point worked with the National Guard. Like, it's so hard to find those examples, but they found one, you know, to show that there's nothing at odds with, you know, law enforcement and military, and, you know, what, a, you know, like an autonomous mutual aid project. And I also saw this, I'm sure people must have mentioned this on your show before, but several states, like governors, were using the term mutual aid to describe like having police or National Guard from another place come and help out. Like, the term mutual aid like had a new law enforcement like use. And I'm just like, how did that happen? Like, when did they get that term, which is so explicitly to me an anarchist term? Like, where, like, what? Yeah, I'd love to know the origins of that.
Well, just kind of going forward, I'm curious, you know, what are some mutual aid projects that you're seeing happening right now or you've seen in the recent period that you think people can really learn from?
Yeah, I just want to re-bring up this, you know, these housing occupations, I think, are really interesting, given the housing crisis is happening in everywhere and that there's also so much empty property because of the ways that, you know, housing is a way for wealthy people to store their wealth. So I'm really, you know, curious about those. And I love the interview you all did with the folks doing the occupation in the Los Angeles area of publicly owned, I think it was Caltrans owned housing, and like the details that interview provided about, you know, like who was guarding the outside at night to like watch the cops while like families were sleeping inside the housing, and just like the kind of logistics of how that's done, I think is really interesting. And the recent victory in Philadelphia of people after having done occupation getting, I think they got 50 families housing out of as a concession from that work. And so I'm curious about like those kinds of tactics. And I think that those are really moving. I I'm a big fan of watched the work of I'm having a brain freeze. Folks in Oakland who are doing direct support to each other around being able to do medical care from the community and training up people on both acute care, like emergencies like gunshots, and also like health issues like long-term things like diabetes and also mental health response. And that's happening in a lot of places beyond Oakland without calling the cops, right? And without calling 911, since the ambulance has always come with the cops. So I'm curious about people like that's, I think, building people's health infrastructure in a way that's really fascinating. It's called Oakland Power Projects. And I think that those examples, and, you know, there's lots of examples of that. There's, you know, a medics team based in Chicago. There's lots of different groups that are like recognizing the inadequacy of health structure. And it really harkens back in some ways to the 1960s and 70s. You know, all the major social movements were also doing free clinics, whether it was like women's clinics or the Black Panther Party's health clinics or all the health work that the Young Lords did, the gay health clinics of the time, et cetera. But so that kind of building health infrastructure feels really, really huge and amazing. And I've been watching those kinds of projects. Obviously, I'm always watching the prison letter writing projects and the prison visitation projects. And a lot of those have turned into projects focused on getting people out during COVID in really like creative and smart ways, and also doing things like trying to find ways to get people to be able to have hand sanitizer inside and things like that, because the situation is so dire inside the prisons, or supporting hunger strikers, et cetera. All of that is mutual aid work that I think is super meaningful. And I think just in general, like, you know, I'm wondering what's going to happen with schools, and I'm curious about what it looks like to do more mutual aid childcare collectives in the time of COVID, and what is possible and what is safe, because I really see there's a very significant crisis happening for parents, which means for children. I feel like the levels of abuse and harm that children are facing because of parents who have to figure out what to do with kids who aren't in school is really intense right now. And I'm just kind of curious, like, what would it look like to try to build more mutual aid around supporting children and parents during this time. And that's something I think is like I'm not hearing as much about, and maybe there's complexity around how to do that safely. But I feel concerned about that, like very concerned.
What are some mistakes that you see mutual aid groups making that you think that people can learn from?
I think one thing is like there's a little bit of complexity around like security culture and mutual aid. Like I think there can be some habits sometimes in organizations and in like the culture of different kinds of organizers to be like really suspicious of everybody. And of course there's like really good reason for that, because we have law enforcement infiltration in our movements for, you know, hundreds of years and all of those things. But I am worried that there can be a kind of like vetting and suspicion that actually makes the groups really insular, and also makes it actually easy to exclude people like because we don't really like them, rather than like because there's actually any threat. And it can be kind of gossipy in the background. And so it can just be kind of like, oh yeah, like no, Dean's fucked up. No, we shouldn't let him in. But nobody's actually like, did Dean actually do anything to anyone? That is like, you know, is there, what does that mean? And is there anything that could be?
Hi, I'm Sarah Jesmer with CKUT. You were just listening to an episode of It's Going Down, a podcast about mutual aid, building support during this crisis and the next. If you want to listen to the rest of this episode, you can find it at It's goingdown.org. This is the December 4th episode, and you can find the rest on their website.
The Prison Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We are dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. With that in mind, we would like to let you know that we have a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters. In fact, we have two phone lines. You can call us Collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviera de Prairie Prison by calling 514-876-3748. We also have a number for non-collect calls. That number is 438-337-8423. Feel free to call that number and leave a message for us with news to share on the show or an audio message for your loved ones inside.
En raison de pandémie, CKUT a décidé de rapporter indéfiniment notre campagne de financement annuelle. Mais nous apprécions toujours les dons pour soutenir nos opérations durant la fermeture. Le moment présent exige des nouvelles approches créatives, et des douzaines d'animateurs et animatrices ont relevé le défi en maîtrisant les logiciels pour vous livrer les émissions de très haute qualité. Nous sommes conscientes que CKUT 90.3 FM vous tient à cœur. C'est pour cette raison que nous faisons appel à votre générosité. Si votre situation vous le permet, nous vous invitons de vous rendre sur notre site web ckut.ca et de faire un don en appuyant sur le bouton vert de donation ou d'envoyer un chèque par la poste à Radio CKUT 3647 rue Université H3A 2B3 Montréal, Québec. Merci.
Pour lutter contre la COVID-19, on doit tous respecter les consignes d'isolement de la santé publique jusqu'au bout. Quand on a des symptômes, on doit s'isoler. Quand on a passé un test, on doit s'isoler. Quand le résultat est positif, on doit s'isoler. Quand on revient de voyage, on doit s'isoler. Et si on a été en contact avec un cas confirmé, on doit s'isoler. S'isoler, c'est sérieux. S'il vous plaît, faites-le. Informations sur québec.ca/isolement. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.